Hello, everyone. My name is Frank Napolitani. I'm the Chief Business Development and Marketing Officer at Stewart & Kissel in New York. And today, I'm joined by Sean O'Dowd, Managing Director and Family Business Advisor at Silvercrest Asset Management as well. Sean, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's my pleasure to have you. So today, we're going to be discussing family office advisory services and how wealth management firms like Silvercrest are providing these unique services, which traditionally have been handled by multiple service providers. Before we really dig into the Q&A here, Sean, if you could spend 2 minutes and tell us about Silvercrest Asset Management.
Sure, absolutely. So we're actually in our 20th year of operations at the moment. And we're quite often referred to as the fifth largest RIA in the US with $30 billion of AUM. A lot of ways we're a multifamily office. So we serve, 700 families as opposed to all those RIAs ahead of us who have, thousands, if not tens of thousands of clients. And our focus is really to be sort of that multifamily office. So we have the investment management components, all domestic equity, fixed income, and so forth. But we also have about 24 portfolio managers who are the ones interacting with our clients. And they'll have anywhere between 25 and 40 relationships. So it's very much a white glove level of service. And as part of that service, we have a family office services group, and we have a family business advisory group, which is what I run.
Understood, and thanks for that. So why don't we dive right into the questions? So if we could, just set the table for us, as we relate to some family company trends and some of the key areas that family companies are in need of help.
One of the areas that I come across, and again, I deal primarily with the family businesses. So clients and prospects that, ultra high net worth families, if they have a business, which tends to be, in a holistic portfolio of things, the biggest asset they have. I'm a reformed investment banker, as many of my friends and colleagues like to joke about. And, when I come into it, there's an issue. And, lately, for instance, it's been liquidity events. And the reason for that, as you can imagine, are, relatively high valuations considering what we've gone through with COVID, an abundance, and I don't use that word lightly, an abundance of capital in private equity and family offices looking to be put to work. It's a great marriage. Now, where I get involved is the family business of the owner, decides, hey, I want to sell the business. And he or she looks to their CFO, and the CFO says, that's great. I run the numbers. I don't know anything about a sales process. Ideally, that's where I get inserted and I can help them figure out not just, what a reasonable valuation level is, but which M&A firms are more sort of up, for this industry of this size of a business, and we interview them and so forth. But also when it comes to a lot of times needing a new lawyer, a new law firm to represent them, because it's not uncommon for me to deal with the family business owner, and she says, "Oh, Sean, why don't we just use my friend Gail? I've known her for the last 20 years. She did my will way back when." And perfectly great person, but in terms of actually being a deal savvy attorney, just not appropriate.
Understood. So, could you give our audience a sense of the landscape of folks that you work with?
Yeah, for the most part, the family businesses that I work with tend to be in the middle markets and lower middle market. And that is purely a function of the fact that, large corporations that are worth billions of dollars that are also family businesses tend to have an internal finance group. So that's not where I can add a huge amount of value, but, you'd be surprised. There are some sizable businesses out there that don't necessarily have strategy when it comes to their finance department. But I'd say 80% middle market is lower middle market. So under $1 billion, so between 25 million and maybe 750 million is kind of the sweet spot.
Understood. So, when you work with these family business owners that are looking to sell their business, what are some of the more popular questions that you get from them?
Is this the right time to sell? And, what they're asking me is, valuation levels and so forth and everything. And I can answer that. You can't predict the future in terms of what valuation levels are going to be. But we all know what a bad time would be, when COVID first hit. It was not good. But sometimes I like to kind of have them ask different questions. And the question that they should be asking them, or I pose them, is like, do you really want to sell? What are your motivations? And if it's just, if there's an external factor that can be solved through a different means, for instance, if there's a, if it's a multi-generational business and you have one generation that wants more liquidity and they're like, I'll just sell the business. Well, that's not necessarily the good reason. We could actually do a special dividend or, you know, some sort of recap. So I really want to get to the root of, hey, you know, the matriarch or patriarch has decided this is the time to sell. The next generation doesn't want to do it. And, you know, they're perfectly happy, you know, retiring or going on to the next stage of their lives. And if I get a feeling that that is absolutely the case, then I'm more than happy to help pursue it with them. And then some of the other questions are, you know, so which M&A advisory firm do we pick? You know, I have a friend at my golf club who works for XYZ firm, and they say they're the best at this. Well, most investment bankers feel that they're the best at any industry, any transaction. So, you know, it's questions like that, sort of how to start the process. So it's very procedural in terms of the questions that are posed.
Understood. And as you're putting together a strategy for these clients, you know, what are some of the things that you focus on in those early stages? Because again, this is something they've never been through before.
Yeah. You know, ideally, I'd like to get involved, you know, prior to this actual sale of the business, get involved 18 months to a year beforehand. And the reason for that is you have to get a lot of things. There's a lot of spring cleaning, if you will. First, with the numbers. So a lot of times I'll say, oh, I'll chat with the CFO and I'll say, well, here's our financials. And ideally they're audited or they have a very top-notch accounting firm that understands their industry. And by reviewing the financials, you get a clear idea in terms of what the company does and how they're positioned and so forth. Unfortunately, that is not always the case.
Right.
So it's working with the CFO, and sometimes you have to replace the accounting firm we're working with and get, you know, a much more upscale firm that can actually take the numbers, you know, and just kind of figure it out. It doesn't always have to be a full-scale audit, but get them to the point where if you're going to be interviewing M&A firms, you can provide them with numbers that are reasonable, so they can provide you with valuation estimates and so forth. And then other times, you know, in working with the company, you can see that there's, you know, there's an area where they need to, from a senior management perspective, need to sort of buff up on. That could be in the role of having a much more senior person in HR. It could be also in the area of IT. Sometimes they just have no one in the IT area and or no, you know, senior management individual. So looking at it from a financial perspective in terms of the financials, but also in terms of the human capital as well.
Understood. So, you know, because these transactions are in essence, you know, selling their baby, you know, a business that they've built up for a number of decades, do you find that the emotional side is almost equal to the economics of a transaction happening for these business owners?
Yes, initially that's definitely the case. After the transaction, it's much more on the emotional side. And so I've learned over the years that, you know, when, you know, a family business owner says, you know, this is the right time to sell, they get involved in the process. Prior to getting the bankers involved, everything like that, I sit down with them and I ask them the question of, you know, what are your plans afterwards? You know, once this is sold, you know, what do you plan to do? Because a lot of times, this is their baby, as you mentioned, and it's also a big part of their identity and also their family's identity. So if that's no longer going to be the case in a controlled sale, they have to kind of figure out, you know, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? And I typically find hard-charging CEO types tend not to just, I mean, they'll take some time out, you know, travel the world, do fun, great hobbyist things, but a lot of them deep down are not hobbyists by nature. I mean, I have a few hobbies here and there. They want to just be in the action somehow. So they want to be still involved. And my biggest recommendation is I always ask them, look, I mean, would you be willing to take a role on a board of a company of, you know, in an adjacent industry? And, you know, what are you passionate about on sort of, let's say, the philanthropic, not-for-profit area? And try and get them involved in boards in both areas, but also giving responsibilities. So they still feel that they're being looked at as a C-level individual and there's responsibilities, but this is something they can manage and also spend a lot of time with children, grandchildren, and so forth.
Sure. Sure. So prior to a sales process really commencing, what are some of the areas that you focus on, you know, for the transaction, you know, post-transaction before it starts? So whether that's tax, trust and estate, succession, those type of things.
Yeah, you know, the first thing is to start with is I get one of my colleagues or partners involved we can work on the trust and estates. Typically, people have a decent plan in place, or they should. It's not always the case, or it needs to be updated. And then we have to start thinking, you know, longer term in terms of what the investments are going to look like after the transaction and so forth. But I leave that up with my portfolio managers. Another area is to make sure that I get a team surrounding them earlier on. So I mentioned the attorney, transaction attorney. I also mentioned, you know, whoever the M&A advisory firm is, but making sure that those individuals actually have a good communication beforehand. Because once the transaction starts happening and you have two or three bidders, let's say, you want to make sure that, you know, a private firm is calling up about information, that the banker and lawyer and whoever else internally can get back to them in a fairly short order with the exact information that they require.
Understood. So staying with the post-transactional side of things here, so how do you and your team at Silvercrest really, you know, work with these newly created family offices? Because oftentimes these are significant investments that they're receiving or transactions that they're receiving, and they're creating that family office. So how do you work with those folks?
So, I mean, the great thing about Silvercrest, so one of the great things is that we have an infrastructure in existence where we can actually be, you know, a family office for this wealthy family. So they don't need to go and create their own, spend the money and the time, to be honest, that they can actually just do it with us. And, you know, getting my partners involved, and so the family business owner understands sort of, okay, so you have this family office services group here, my investments will be covered by this individual here, and you all coordinate it going forward. Got it, makes sense. And so they can ask the questions. Oh, I was thinking about, you know, this in terms of alternative investments, you know, what's going to happen with that, or how are we going to plan for this? And it's just a matter of introducing the individuals and the professionals earlier on.
Got it. Understood. So from all the reports that I read about the family office market, it doesn't seem like it's going to be slowing down with, you know, newly created multimillionaires on a daily basis. And given that the S&P 500 has continued to gone up since March of 2009, how are you guys at Silvercrest, you know, dealing with the growth of these new family offices and the number of them coming into the firm, and whether it be from a services perspective, a bandwidth or infrastructure perspective, can you talk about that?
It's more on the educational level. So there's some families that are going to come into wealth that'll be significant enough to, let's say $2 billion, which is for, and you know, for someone like that or a family like that, maybe it makes sense for them to have their own family office. However, that take in consideration the fact that if you have your own family office, it's great to have your name on the door or what have you, but to go out and hire a team of professionals that's going to be able to manage the money, maybe do private equity and so forth and family office services, takes a lot of time and takes a huge amount of energy. And it might seem great for 2 or 3 years to say, oh, we have our own family office. But at some point, you know, and it's not just the money because they can afford it, it's the time and energy it takes to oversee it. And let's say they want to go on safari in Africa for a couple months. Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to do to break yourself away because, you know, you're the head of that family office. So, you know, in terms of the educational component, for people to understand sort of, you know, what's really required for a family office, and, you know, they don't have to do their own. They can simply come to us and have it all taken care of.
Understood. So, you know, many of the family companies that you deal with, you know, they're privately owned. Let's discuss the big increase of private capital versus publicly traded securities and the impact that's going to have or continue to have with the ultra high net worth market with that and how they invest.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the private market, and this is something that I think we're all fairly familiar with, it's grown in significance, as have private equity, venture capital, family offices, and this has been going on 15, 20 plus years. And, you know, sophisticated families are realizing that, hey, you know, it's, you know, to be completely invested in the public markets might not be the best avenue. I was fortunate to have David Swenson when I studied at Yale, and, you know, he's obviously a big proponent of the private capital component. It's not going away, it's growing. The key is, again, it's an educational sort of being there and letting people know sort of what area that provides within their overall portfolio, you know, how it can help offset risk, how it can actually increase, you know, risk-adjusted return, because it for a lot of people, it's a complete new area. And to your point, it's not going away, and it's going to take it on much more of, I think we're going to be reading it a lot more.
Understood. Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed it. Hopefully our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Well, thank you. So please be on the lookout for our next episode of our conversation series from Seward and Kissel. Thanks, everyone.